This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
So last night, I went to my little cousin's ISA festival. It's actually not called ISA anymore. It was called ISA for like 15 years, but they just changed it to SASA, to South Asian Student Association. And they just had their little festival where, you know, all these high schoolers are just dancing and singing and whatnot. And my cousin is an officer for the club. I think he's like historian or something. And he was telling me that like all the officers got beef. And he was supposed to go up to do the fashion show, but they like didn't call his name when it was his time. So like the MC called out Noor, but like he didn't come out. He's in the bathroom or something because they didn't know they were calling men out. And like all of his officers purposely didn't tell him that it was his time. So now they got, you know, a bunch of beef, and he's not stressing about it. He's like, yo, I don't care, it's high school, which is very grown up for a high school to say. But Ani, I want to ask you ever have any like high school beef with anybody?
Oh man, high school is a long time back for me. Let me think. I definitely had beef in high school for sure. Not with no brown people, yeah.
No,
because that's not really my style. I definitely had beef in high school. I'm trying to think. Yeah, I had some smoke, but it was like, I don't know. It's
whatever.
It's really not worth talking about. Yeah, I was.
Gotcha.
You know, I think.
Gotcha. We grown up.
Yeah, it's nothing significant. It was like, you know, somebody got mad. I didn't pass the ball during gym, you know.
Oh, man.
He probably that's couldn't where it score starts. Anyway. And
for real.
You know, I used to rap in high school, so I had like these fake rap beefs with other kids, which was cool. Like we used to battle and do fun stuff. But I never had no real beef till I was an adult. But that's, you know, that's part of life.
Till I was an adult.
For sure.
That's where it
was
all started.
Like, was it like in your school? Was it in your school beef, or was it like you were beefing with other schools and stuff?
Nah, it was no interstate.
The
beef.
Whole district. Oh,
got you.
Yeah,
gotcha.
I'm not a big beef person, man. There's just a code that I grew up on, which is like, you know, you can't give everything a voice, and so I'm really like.
I like that.
To get me going, it takes a lot. Once I'm going, it's over for people, but it really takes right. me a lot to get going. So for yeah.
That's I got smart. You, Mo. You had any beef?
I had beef. But you know,
any beef, any smoke with nobody?
Yeah.
Not with that time.
There's beef. I remember this one girl
about.
Pushed me once in the cafeteria.
Damn.
Because
what
I had beef.
What you do?
I don't even remember what I did. I didn't do anything to her specifically. I think there was something said to her friend that she thought I did. But I was like, I'm just like a little girl pushing
man.
Me.
You were subtweeting.
Yeah. No, yeah, it's definitely crazy. Not subtweeting. But yeah, I'm done with that.
Thank you guys so much for joining us again on our podcast, beautiful podcast, difficult-ish podcast about South Asian narratives. My name is Mashnoon.
I'm Mahua.
And today we're joined by a very, very, very special guest, someone who I've been following for a really long time. We have Ani Sanyal. He is an entrepreneur, investor, hustler. He's done a bunch of stuff, real estate, digital marketing, will be here forever. But most importantly, he's a brown man in America who is just, you know, put his life in his own hands and is chasing his dreams. So, Ani, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate the time and having me on.
I'm so excited to have you because I feel like everything that you do it so, like, gracefully, and you make it seem like everyone can also achieve it because with the talent and the skills that you have, you like share it with everyone as well. So I really like that about you because a lot of people in society, they kind of
giving man.
They gatekeep it. So you do so many things at the same time, but you don't make it look hard at all. You know, like I don't see you ever complaining about it. You're always like passionate about it. You're always like humble about it and you're always grateful about it, which I really appreciate.
That's deep. Thank you. I think that's been a probably a core focus of mine over the last couple of years, just kind of maturing, you know, my brand and thinking about what really matters. So I appreciate that. I could talk about that all day, but I'm happy that some people are able to see that. That's real.
I wanted to talk about when I first came across you. It was actually when I was like 18 or 19 years old. It was your TED Talk that you did at Boston University, which is funny because the two of us actually just spoke at Boston University like 2 weeks ago for Bhasha D. Bush. Thank you. It was for Mother Language Day for Bangladesh. We had the opportunity to speak out there. So funny how we're here. But you know, I feel like I heard your TED Talk at a super important time in my life when like I needed to hear the message that you were preaching just about like, you know, I was at a point in my life where like I was trying to figure out like, okay, I got these things that I love doing, but I also got these things that like I have to do, but I also got to make bread, but I also got to do this and that. And just, you know, finding the crossroads between all that can be difficult, especially when you're a kid. So hearing that from somebody that, you know, looks like me at a time when I needed it, it meant a lot, you know.
That's incredible. I didn't know that. That's real. Thank you.
I'm trying to think of when I first saw you in the scene, because like I grew up in New York. I was born and raised here. But I think I first saw you like when you were with Anik Khan and how you were managing him and you were with him. And then obviously when Kolkata Jha became such a big thing in New York City, I think that was the initial time. And I just saw that you were with Anik, but then you're also like managing Kolkata Jha and doing all the behind the scenes for that business. And I looked more into you and I was like, how is he doing all of these things at the same time, you know? So I really, like, as a business owner myself, I really appreciated seeing the transparency and also just seeing, you know, someone like you that is also born and raised here, but having like a South Asian background, having you're Bengali American, right? Or do you say Indian American? Do you say Bengali American?
That's a good question. It's so like bifurcated for us. Yeah. Right? I am an Indian American, but I'm Bengali culturally. Mm-hmm. So yeah, Kolkata Bengali, if you will. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's I don't want to say it's the same thing to me because that's not the appropriate thing to say. But you know, culturally, it's such an interesting point that intersection that we live at, mm-hmm. right? When you're culturally one thing but nationality is something else. But yeah, I guess I identify as an Indian American just for like the factual part of it.
Right. Yeah, I think a lot of people now mix up like Bengali and Bangladeshi, but yeah, I think you're an Indian American. It was just really inspiring to see someone like you, you know, coming up with like the same type of upbringing as so many of us and just doing what you're doing and you know, killing it. It was amazing.
I think that that difficulty with like figuring out how to navigate like culture and identity starts really early for like a lot of us. Like I was born in New York, but I grew up like mostly in Orlando, and I grew up with a big Spanish community with not many people nor any people that look like me around me. So I ran around saying I was Guyanese and Dominican my whole life. And I know Mo grew up with a lot of Indian people and not very many Bengali people. I want to hear a little bit about your upbringing in Boston. How do you like Boston? We weren't big fans of Boston. I mean, we were very like centered towards like downtown. It was a lot of white folk. They had good cannolis. The cannolis were good. But I want to hear a little bit about your upbringing in Boston.
What did a great assessment?
Yeah, that's all you got. Nice pier. Nice harbor.
Not too much going on there. Actually was born. So I was born in Western Massachusetts, pretty far from Boston, 4 or 5 hours from Boston. My dad was a grad student. He moved here, a typical first gen immigrant story. Well, first, he wasn't even first gen. Typical immigrant story. My parents moved here in the winter of 87. And the way I grew up was, I don't want to say it was difficult because I had two loving parents that really were willing to go to the mat for me every day and, you know, do whatever's necessary for the family. So I could never sit here and say I had a difficult childhood. I mean, it was hard objectively, but I knew that I had the love of my parents. And I think that's something that you can see in the way that I move today. You know, I try to reciprocate that every day, really kind of living out a life that they would be proud of, even though I'm independent of them in every single way. It's important to honor them in that way. But I grew up in Western Mass. You know, we grew up in this one bedroom apartment. The story I think that could define my childhood is we had this mustard colored couch in our living room. And, you know, I was 3-4 years old and it was just a regular couch to me. I'd throw Hot Wheels off of it. I, you know, try to crawl under it. And it had three legs. And so one leg was always on a soup can or something, you know, a stack of books or something. And I thought that was normal. I was a kid. And, you know, years later, decades later, I found out that my dad had actually dragged that couch out of a trash can, out of like a dumpster, because he saw it and he was like, I need a couch. And he was like, this looks fairly clean. Like, I don't know why somebody would throw it out. Oh, it has three legs. I could work with that. You know, and I think about that moment for him, you know, being an adult, really putting your pride to the side and being like, you know, this is what I can afford or what I can do. And that's what I'm gonna do for my family. I think that is a very, just a very unique and descriptive story of kind of how we grew up. You know, it wasn't a lot physically and materially, but there was a lot in terms of love and you know, that type of security. So I would say, you know, I grew up financially insecure, but I grew up very emotionally secure. And that, I think, has shaped a lot of my story. So I don't know if that answers all the questions, but yeah, I moved to, you know, a suburb outside of Boston, probably in my, I can't remember, early teens, you know, around then, maybe late, whenever, 9, 10 years old. And never felt comfortable until I moved out of that state, out of Massachusetts. And part of what you guys alluded to was definitely a factor. I think one thing, I'm assuming you guys are under 30, and I'm going to go ahead and say, you know, between 25 to 30, if that, life today is very different for people of color, for first generation immigrant kids, because there are representative points out there, right? I don't really like the word representation because I think it's very two-dimensional, but we'll talk about that later. You could go up, you could turn on the TV and see someone that looks like you. Yep. If we fast forward 20, 30 years ago, when I grew up, there was none of that. And so identity was a very difficult thing because there was nothing to model around. And to your point, you know, you said you grew up around, you know, Spanish folks and, you know, you had to take a certain identity. For me, it was just like, you know, America was binary. It was white or black. And so there wasn't even like a, you know, a relevant reference point. And so I grew up in that, you know, in that, that struggle to find identity. And looking back, I think a lot of things that I do now are still, are ways of living out my inner child. You know, Kolkata Chai is such a, it's such an aggressive, you know, way to be like, no, this is our culture. We're going to put a flag down for it. You know, Anik Khan is such a billboard literally for, South Asian creativity, you know, and I've been behind that for years, you know, and I own that because I know growing up, that's all I wanted to see. So long-winded answer to say, you know, I think a lot of what I do today is meant to kind of heal that part of me as a kid that was very confused or just frustrated that there was nobody, you know, that I could see in my story or share my story to.
No, I really liked the story about you saying how, like, even though you didn't grow up with much, your parents never made you feel like you didn't have enough, and they never made you feel like, you know, you're like starving. Like, they still gave you everything that they could, even if they didn't have the means to do it. And I think that shows in a lot of, you know, children of immigrants, like that shows in our work as well, where we grow up with more respect and more gratitude towards them, and our work is dedicated to them because we know that they tried their best. And like, what, on top of what you said about like healing your inner child and healing that like broken self that you had when you were younger, because you didn't have that, you know, the people around you that look like you, it is, I feel like that's what drives so many of us now, because we're like, oh, we didn't have this growing up, so now we're doing it for our younger self, but also helping the people after us, which I love and appreciate so much.
For sure. For sure.
Yeah. And I think, like, going back to what you said about, you know, I want to hear a little bit more about why you don't like the word representation. But before that, you know, we're 24, so we only grew up with like Baljeet from Phineas and Ferb, or we saw like, what else did we see? Just like Robbie, random like ass fingers,
Robbie
like
from Jesse,
Robbie Simpsons. from Jesse. So like we had something to work on. We had Apu from Simpsons. Like, we had something. And, you know, I love seeing like Apu and Simpsons. And, like, you know, I love seeing like these figures, because I remember when I was like a baby, I didn't have nobody. And, you know, I can't imagine for you, like, through like your actual aging years and teenage years, like, not having anybody to really connect to. And I know that, you know, you said that America at the time was very like white and black. And obviously, with us not being able to connect at all to the white side. I know hip hop culture has been, you know, something really pivotal on your journey. I want to hear a little bit more about how that's kind of affected you, what tenets you've gotten out of, you know, being embraced by hip hop culture, black culture. You know, you eventually moved to New York City to follow, you know, your dreams within the music industry. I want to hear a little bit about that, and also what about the word representation that you don't like?
Yeah, I'll tackle the first part first. I think, you know, I'm very open about kind of being indebted to hip hop culture and as an extension, black culture. I think black culture in America is, it is one of the most dynamic cultural and creative and commercial forces, I think, that we've ever seen. I think it scares the establishment, which is why, you know, the implicit racism of our structure is even more intensified, because people can't accept that black culture is as powerful as it is. And I think growing up for me, I mean, in a way it was like, you know, if you're not white, then where's the next reference point, you know, and hip hop music, specifically Jay-Z and that idea of like entrepreneurship or just owning something and being able to earn a living off of it and obviously building a brand around it. I mean, I think I was probably, 12 years old when I was like, no, that is what I want to do, you know, and in some ways, decades later, nothing has changed. But hip hop culture is huge for me. I think, like I said, I think the creativity of black culture is something that everybody borrows from, whether they want to accept it or not, or realize it or not, or acknowledge it or not. And I hope that changes, you know, in our lifetime. I hope that we're able to, you know, kind of find equal footing in society for that. But yeah, I mean, let's talk about hip hop. I mean, this is the 50-year anniversary of hip hop. I just went to the gallery at the Fotografiska the other day. And, you know, it was just like, it's so interesting for me, because I grew up, my parents were like, turn that music off, pull your pants up. You know, what are you doing? This is terrible. Like, you know, my dad, who is, you know, we're keeping it real, he's an intellectual to the core, but he's also very elitist in a lot of ways. And he was just like, this is garbage, you know, and I've talked about this with him, so he knows what time it is, but he was just like, this is garbage. And I was like, nah, it's not. There's a lot of struggle and stories and things being told here that you're not able to see, because you're just focused on them cursing or the fact that, you know, black people may make you uncomfortable because that's what you were taught growing up, you know, and I wasn't ready for that conversation as a 12-year-old, but, you know, in my 30s, that's a conversation we have all the time. But long story long, you know, hip hop culture changed America. You know, there's a book called The Tanning of America by Steve Stout, who was a music manager, marketing executive. And I read that book in my 20s, and it's something that I recommend, you know, everybody read, especially if you, you know, consume hip hop culture. Even nowadays, I feel like culture is hip hop culture, but that's a conversation for another day. But The Tanning of America basically talks about how, from a marketing and branding and cultural consumption side, hip hop has changed the fabric of America forever, you know, and my dad used to think, or people used to think, it was a fad. It was, you know, it was garbage. It was something that, you know, it was only for the kids. And now, you know, Fortune 500 companies build their marketing and language and copy and all that brand identity from hip hop culture. So I think, not to give myself credit, you know, but I just think being open-minded, you know, and not letting my parents kind of dictate or control what I was going to consume, partially credited on them. You know, they were like, well, whatever, you know, we got to let this kid do what he wants. And part of it is on me to be like, nah, I'm not going to let you talk to, you know, a certain culture, a certain people, a certain idea that way. So yeah, hip hop culture taught me everything. It taught me about identity in the sense of telling your story, regardless of what that is, if it's not the mainstream narrative. Taught me how to hustle, taught me about entrepreneurship, basically taught me how to take an idea, build influence, and then sell things back with that influence, which is, you know, what I do today. And it really taught me about what's possible. You know, like you could put words together, which would lead to a song, which would lead to you performing that song, which would lead to making money off that song. You know, and I break it down very simplistically, but that's basically creation, right? And kind of the ripple effect of what you create. So yeah, hip hop culture changed me forever.
I think one of the main points of connectivity for me growing up was just like the conversation around struggle. 'Cause, you know, the struggle isn't the same, but you know, we both struggle in our own respective ways. And, you know, the conversation of struggle wasn't something that I was able to have with the fair skin. It was something that, you know, things that I was going through, I was only really able to connect to people that look like me or have like the same shade as me. And when I, you know, same kind of thing, like growing up, I heard this and that about when I was listening to rap or when I was watching battle rap, like on YouTube. And my main selling point to my mom was like, yo, mom, like mom, why are they yelling? Why are they cursing? Why are they mad at each other? I'm like, they're not mad at each other. They're just mad. Like, they're just angry, you know, because like, yeah, white people, fair skin, go about having these conversations in a different way. But this is how these people react after years and years of whatever, you know. And so that concept of struggle was something that I was really able to connect to growing up. And I grew up on a bunch of battle rap, and I grew up, you know, that manifested into like I started doing spoken word poetry when I was in high school, and it was like super rap heavy. It was literally rap, but like I was too scared to yell. I was a baby back then, so I was basically rapping, but I was like saying it calmly and whatever. I know one of your favorite artists and one of my favorite artists, is Nipsey Hussle. And one on an interview that he did a while ago, he said this quote that I really liked, and it's kind of been like my mantra for my whole life moving forward. He said, I'm gonna butcher it, but he said,
is it the war with the world one?
No, it's about like the delusional man. Damn, I literally forgot the term. Mm-hmm, he said, mm-hmm. he basically said like, all necessary
progress depends on the irrational man.
I literally butchered it. I knew I was going to. But I want to use that quote as a segue into, you know, you going into your mid-20s, you were working, you were hustling, and you were kind of giving up a lot to make your dreams come true. How did you go about kind of sacrificing your mid-20s to the hustle, to entrepreneurship, to business? How did you go about having these types of conversations with your parents, telling them, hey, this is going to take a while, and I know you wanted me to go this route, but I'm not doing that? And you know, how valuable is it to just be delusional?
Yeah, that's such a great question. When I think about it sometimes now, I'm like, was I crazy? I was definitely crazy, delusional, if you will. Wow, what a start. You said a lot of great.
First of all, my fault.
No, you're good. I'm just going through. We're going to get to the representation question. Just make a note of that. We'll come back to it.
Damn, I literally forgot about that. I'm sorry.
It's all good. Yeah. Battle rap. I'm going to ask you after we get off air who you listen to. But I think battle rap should be in museums. I think it's absolutely genuinely one of the greatest art forms, and I think people will be studying it, you know, 5-10 years from now.
You got a favorite before we move forward? You got a favorite?
Man, I mean, I do, but I don't know what era you're. My favorite's Hitman, Sue Surf.
That's when I started.
Oh, he loves Sue Surf. Okay. Oh,
yeah, Press God. Nine. I was there. I was a baby.
All I listen to is Surf now. I don't know why. Me and my brother have been listening to Surf nonstop for like 4 weeks.
Free the Wave.
That's all we do, Free to Wave. Unfortunately, man, I don't want to get into it. Yeah, it's hard to get out of a Rico case. Let's just put that. But yeah, Surf is a beast. There's a lot of tangents we could take. So my 20s.
Your 20s.
I will be honest. My 20s were some of the most definitive, exhilarating, incredibly rewarding, but difficult times I've ever been through. And it, a lot of things obviously contributed to that. But I think about now where I am in my 30s, and life is difficult, but it's different. And what I mean by that is, I think in my 20s, it was time to show and prove, you know, like if I wanted to do this, if I wanted to live this full life, creatively and entrepreneurially, which I knew I wanted to do since I was 12, I had to put numbers on the board when I was 20, you know, in my 20s, meaning I had to figure out how to pay for, you know, myself. I had to figure out how to create income for, you know, the future. And I had to figure out how to build in a foundation that would allow me to even be alive in my 30s, if you will. Right. And it sounds so do or die, but that's what it felt like for me. And the problem was, there was so much tension because there's so many dichotomies, and I'll get into that. Meaning, I went to college begrudgingly. And what I mean by that.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
That is, I'm very grateful that I went to school. I'm very grateful that my parents, you know, knew the importance of it and kind of pushed me to definitely follow through on it. But I knew at 18 that I didn't really want to go to college, meaning I had a conviction, the same conviction I had that when I was 12 that I have now when I'm 34, was like, nah, I'm going to do this in my own way. And I have this just incredible level of conviction. I think it's a divine thing, but I knew that school was not going to let me get to where I wanted to get to. I knew that going in. And so I really struggled with just accepting, like, man, I got to do 4 years here. It's going to cost me and my family X amount of money. It's going to be, you know, this burden financially. But then I ended up getting into NYU, which was like, obviously we all, you know, and this is a long time ago. And today NYU, the brand has even grown more, but like, what a privilege, you know what I mean? What a privilege to even be able to have that opportunity. And I say that now, I say that today, kind of being on the other side of it. At the time I was like, I need to get to New York. So NYU sounds fine, you know, sounds great. It could have been CUNY, it could have been whatever. I knew that I had to be in New York. Again, conviction. But where I was going with all this is I went to NYU and again, really struggled to figure out like, what was I going to do with my time here? Because there's this academic pressure, right? There's social pressure. And then there's me and my conviction where it's like, now I'm here to figure out what I'm doing with my life. I could care less if I make friends. I'm still that way, respectfully. Like my social life is whatever. I have an incredible group of people in my life, but I'm not here for that. We could shake hands and be friends later. I got to figure out what my business, like I got to figure out my life. Because if I don't figure out what I'm doing, I feel like I'm in a prison, you know? And this is what I was thinking about when I was 18, 19, 20. I wasn't really going to parties. Like obviously we all go out, we all have that era, but I wasn't really out like that. Like I was just always trying to figure things out. And so to your point about sacrifice, like that was just built in because I knew that in order to get to where I had to get to, I had to sacrifice. And today the life I lead is all built on things that I did when I was 19 and 20, and it sounds crazy. So I'll delve into it a bit. In school, I studied economics, I studied finance. I did like a double major with Stern, the business school, because I knew that in order to make money, I need to be close to money. And what that did was it put me in a B school environment. I was around a lot of sharp kids. You know, getting involved with the stock market and investing and not really knowing anything as a 19, 20 year old, but at least I'm getting exposure to it. I started working at a hedge fund part-time and I was going to school in the evening. So I'd work 9 to 5 during the day and then I'd go to school in the evening. Or I'd work my schedule around this part-time analyst job I had at a hedge fund. When I was 19, 20, maybe I couldn't get into the club. I might've been 20, 21. I can't remember, but I did that and I was like, you know what? I'm making enough money here where I can actually move. I don't need to live in a dorm. Like I could save, you know, that cost for whatever. So I used to live on 19th and Park Avenue when I was 19, 20 years old.
Wow.
I had mad roommates, you know, it was a whole situation, but I used to live on Park Ave and my office used to be on 32nd and Park Avenue. So I used to walk 10 blocks, this dynamic that was like, okay, this hip hop kid is now going into this like, you know, finance environment. Then I would leave the office and if I didn't have class or even after class, I would go to the studio and I would go make music or be around my creative friends. I'd be in Canarsie at 2 a.m. on a Wednesday and, you know, have to get back to Park Avenue on Thursday morning. It was wild times in the hood. Like it's a different era, right? New York 10, 20 years ago.
What year is this? Just for some context.
Yeah, it's 08. 07, 08. And so long story long, I learned this finance world. My dad is so proud. He's so happy. You know what I mean? I got this button up shirt every day and I'm basically what I'm doing is I'm assessing my risk. I'm like, yo, do I need to do this or do I need to be creative? And I'm trying to figure out what the risk reward is. Long story long, I did about a year and change in that situation. And one day I just quit. I walked away from Park Avenue. I went and lived in Borough Park, Brooklyn, in this illegal apartment with my homie, because it was $500 a month for two people.
Yeah.
And we could make music in that apartment. And so what was going on is, during the day, I'd be in class, or in the evening, I'd be in class with my finance homies. These guys were going to UBS, Goldman Sachs, you know, they were going into private equity. And I was in the same circle as them. And then we're about to graduate, and that's what they're doing. And they're like, yo, what are you doing? And I was like, man,
I'm rapping.
I don't know. You know, like, I don't know what I'm doing. And I remember I got this consulting job offer, which was some bullshit. No, sorry, the curse. It was some shit. You know what I mean? I just got it. And the person, the CEO at an interview, he was like, man, I looked you up on YouTube. You got all this music stuff going on. This is 08, 09, damn, 2010, somewhere in that era.
You're on YouTube back then. I see you got
music. Man, come on. Contact boys early. He was like, I see you making music. You're doing all this thing. Like, do you really want a job? And I still remember this. I still remember this thing. He was like, are you going to work this job? Like, this is before I got hired. And I was like, no, sir. Like, I come from immigrant parents. Like, I'm ready to work. And I'm lying. I know I'm lying. You know, and I still remember. I was like, nah, I want this job. I quit that job 2 weeks after I started.
There we go.
And I'm 21 years old. I've just graduated. My friends are all in banking or private equity, or, you know, some decent paying tech job. And I have no job. I'm living in Bushwick at this time. Shout out, you know, my whole Bushwick crew back then. Mm-hmm. And I want to be creative. It's 2010. It's a recession.
Yeah.
And I had no option but to figure it out. You know, so I just want to paint, I know I'm saying a lot, but I want to paint the context for how desperate I was to be creative and live life on my own terms. And fast forward a bit, you know, 3-4 months. So basically what I'm doing is I'm an artist at this time. I'm rapping, I'm producing music, I'm managing a group, and I'm kind of working with this like larger creative collective in Brooklyn. It's called the Brooklyn Good Guys. And so we're throwing events, we're throwing parties, we're making music, we're doing little shows and tours. And what I didn't mention was, in college I actually was the first person in New York to bring Wiz Khalifa to perform. So
yeah, I was gonna bring that up.
Show at the basement of Webster Hall in 2008, and that was organized by me.
Oh, the basement.
And damn, we had brought, you know, I just had this a whole story on the side. I'm just cut and paste, but basically I was figuring out stuff in music, and Wiz had called me after. He's like, yo, I want you to come on tour with me. And so we did a couple, you know, we did this like short run with him, and I have all these experiences, and I still go get this job after graduating. I worked 2 weeks and I quit, and I was like, what am I going to do? And then we had this showcase, or I was doing some show in Harlem 4 or 5 months after. And this guy comes up to me. He's like, yo, like, are you interested in going to Japan for with your group? Like, I have this opportunity to go tour in Japan for 3 weeks. And I was like, what do you mean? You know, what is that?
Are you like mid semester right now?
No, this is after I graduated.
Oh, this is after. Okay. Gotcha.
I quit my job. I'm broke. I'm eating dollar tacos, and I'm basically working random side gigs with my NYU degree just so I could be creative. And I went to Japan when I was 21 years old with two of my best friends. The trip that I basically coordinated as a 21-year-old kid, where we licensed a part of our catalog musically to have this company pay for the entire trip. And we were going for this music festival, whatever. The reason I mentioned this is that moment became the crystallizing moment for me as a creative and entrepreneur. I was extremely young, and I had done what I thought at that time was my wildest dream, right? I was across the world living off of music with my best friends, some of whom are my best friends still today. And I was like, oh, nobody could tell me anything. Like, I think I might be onto something. So that's, I don't know if I answered the question. I think I told more stories than anything else, but I think that's what it was, is I really put it all on the line to follow this conviction I had, and I starved and I sacrificed through it. But then I had this moment where I was like, oh, I can't go back. You know, I was 21, and I knew that I could never go back, meaning I could never work a day job. I could never, you know, have somebody tell me what I can or can't do, because I had done the impossible. You know what I mean? I was a brown kid in Tokyo. It's 2000. No, it's 2010. I'm 21 years old. Like, it was just this definitive moment for me to be like, nah, you could do this. You know, you just got to go up against everything every day, but you can do it if you want it. And I carry that memory with me really, really close, because yeah, it was real.
And I think, kind of to sum all that up, that's why I loved your TED Talk when I first came across it, because it was kind of portraying that message of like finding our balance between what we love to do and what we have to do is always going to be difficult, and it's never going to be clear cut, but we always have to, you know, we can't put our passions and our, you know, what we truly love fully aside. You know, it has to always be there, because, you know, I think growing up as brown kids, we're always kind of told to, like, you know, you can enjoy life after you're this, that, and you're 65, you know, then you can whatever, go travel. And I think a lot of us are inherently taught that, like, you know, life isn't yet meant to be lived until a certain point. And something that the two of us kind of preach on this podcast is like, yo, like, take that trip now, like, start that book now, like, start that business now. Even if you can't start it, like, start learning about it, start reading, start educating yourself. Education doesn't have to be through a classroom. It can be on Google. It could be through the people around you. And I think just like that essence of starting is something that a lot of people are scared about. And something else that I want to ask you was, I think you said it maybe in like your TED Talk or some shit, but you said something about being okay with embracing failure and not necessarily being excited for it, but being okay that it's inevitable and it'll happen. And I think that that's something that a lot of us struggle with, because we never want to disappoint, you know, the people that have given us life, and we never want to disappoint anybody around us. Whereas, you know, the people that do choose to put their own life in their hands and pursue an entrepreneurial career, failure can happen. So what kind of input do you have about the term failure, and how have you kind of became okay with it?
Wait, I'm listening to all of this just because I find all of this so fascinating, but I also think it's so interesting, because I think a lot of people, especially in their 20s, they think that they have to have everything figured out. They don't want to fail. They just feel like a failure, especially when they're going through, you know, money problems or anything, you know, that they think that they should be successful completely in their 20s, and they feel like a failure if they're not. But, you know, listening to your story and seeing that you had so many ups and downs with financial stability and like your career and so many different things, and seeing also how much more you're thriving now that you're in your 30s, and how you started really pushing towards, you know, what you're doing now in your late 20s and early 30s, I think it's just so hopeful to people that think that they should have everything figured out, like, right after high school, even in high school when you're like picking your college. And it's just very inspiring to hear that, you know, there's life outside of that. And that's why so many people say, like, in your 30s, that's where your confidence comes out, you know?
I think one more thing, that's also why I first really started to like Anikon, was because, like, he didn't put out his first record when he was 18 or like when he was like 16, whereas like we're told, like we see all these like successful ass 18-year-olds like becoming millionaires, where it's like I believe like Anik started earlier. Like, I remember in like one of the songs on Kites, he says something about like I'm 27 sleeping on like a bunk bed like with my sister, something like that. So that's something that I've always really, really loved about him and your message as well.
No, thank you for sharing. And I realize I'm telling you guys a bunch of sagas, so I want to keep these answers tighter. The question about failure, I think it's interesting how society and just the human condition we are in now, we assume that you're not supposed to fail. Failure is actually the default state when you try something difficult or something new, you know, like, you will fail. It's not even you can fail, you will fail. And I think that for all the obvious reasons, failure scares, you know, especially first gen immigrant kids, it scares people that don't have a backstop, right? If you don't have a safety net, failure can be really scary. But I also think failure is, like I said, I think it's default. I think you fail more times than you succeed, and I think you learn a lot more from when you fail than you succeed. One of my mentors, and I talk about this a lot in pods, is one of my mentors had this saying that he used to just always put on me, because I was such a stubborn, you know, 20-year-old, mid-20-year-old kid when I was like, I'm not failing. He would always tell me, fail to learn, you know. And that was all he said. He said, fail to learn. And I was like, well, what do you mean? And he was basically like, you fail so you can learn, but if you fail to learn from your failures, then you're going to keep doing it, you know. And it was like, you know, deep little thing that I've always kept with me. And I'll just, and I don't know if we're going to get to it, but I'll preempt it, is like, you know, I'm 34, 10 years ago, my kidneys failed, you know? So when we talk about failure in your 20s, I was 24 years old going up against not knowing if I would turn 25, you know? So perspective is a big part of my career too. And I just bring that up, you know, as a reminder, like, yeah, for sure. You know, you go on TikTok and you see a 19-year-old kid selling sneakers and you're like, damn, like, I wish I could be that. But I was in Tokyo, Japan 1 year and doing this and doing that. And the next year, my kidneys ran out, you know, and I was like, okay, well, I got to deal with failure in my career or whatever, but I also have to deal with, you know, the expiration of life as a whole. And I think that really gave me perspective to say, you know, failure is not what you think it is, right? Failure is not putting out a blog post or putting out a song or putting out a painting that doesn't get the love that it deserves. Failure is not being able to make it to your 30s, right? Failure is your life ending and you not being able to live it in the way that you did. And so I obviously it's very unique to me, and I know that doesn't apply for everybody, but that's given me a lot of perspective.
No, and I really like that. Even if that specifically doesn't relate to a lot of people, I think everybody can relate to, like, you know, when we get into our 20s, it's hard to decipher, like, career / work / passion to just, like, real life, like, what's going on, like, at home, what's going on with my mother, what's going on with, oh, like, now I got a kid, like, oh, now I got blah, blah, blah. And it's like, you stress so much about what you think is really worth stressing about until something really happens. And, you know, I'm not looking for everybody to have a life-changing experience like that, but, you know, I preach about perspective all the time, whether it was, like, perspective about growing up in various cultures, various settings, growing up with people that don't look like me, learning from, you know, traveling, going, whatever. I think perspective is one of the most invaluable, you know, pieces of human experience. So thank you for sharing that as well.
Not for sure. And I think everyone has to find perspective in their own scenario, regardless. It doesn't have to be struggle. You know, perspective is objective. And I think that's something that I think is so important.
Would you say that's maybe, like, one of the leading kind of pinpoints that you've gotten out of, like, your mid-20s? Because I think I personally search for advice on, like, just life advice from, like, 24, 25. Because I feel like it's a funny time, because, like, I remember when I graduated, like, the day after my graduation, I was like, damn, like, everybody in my life just told me that, like, graduate and life would be great. But then you graduate, you're like, damn, like, what the hell do I do? Like, I know absolutely nothing. So what do you feel like, or if it was the perspective part, but if not, what do you feel like is kind of just, like, a key takeaway out of, like, your mid-20s?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I got the cheat code, right? Because I almost lost my life in my mid-20s. So that level of perspective just allowed me to really build a very, like, fulfilling life after that, right? That was, I call it a cheat code nowadays, because I'm like, damn, that just gave me so much. It gave me so much, right? Going back, I don't know if I'd do it again, but, you know, right. it gave me a lot. So I'm grateful for that. Patience, I think, is the other thing. You know, in our 20s, it's so hard to be patient. I used to be the most impatient person when it came to, you know, career and money and creative, and nothing happens when you want it to. That's part of life. I think developing a sense of patience and a sense of a long-term gratification cycle is really important. And I don't want to pontificate too much, but the life I lead now is a life that I used to think about when I was 16. Right? How am I going to live on my own terms, pay myself, hire my friends, be creative, create work that impacts, not have a boss, you know, all these things that I literally just think about this when I was 16, 17 years old. I'm 34. What'd it take me? 18 years, right? It takes that long to build something, especially if you're coming from zero. If your daddy ain't set up the trust fund, and if you're not inheriting something, whether it's money or, you know, resources or infrastructure, if you're not inheriting that, you got to really start at zero, and it takes time. Yeah, you could go viral. You know, anybody can go viral, but what do you build after that virality? Are you around 18 years after that? That's a test that I think that we're going through right now, right? Our generation right now is really like so used to short-term gratification. Mm-hmm. We'll see what's popping in 10 years, you know, but for me, I feel like, man, I had that, you know, I was on stage with Wiz Khalifa. What year were you? Damn near 15, 20 years ago, right? Like not 20, 15 years ago. Like I'm still here, you know, and obviously we're in different places and all that. And I didn't make it as a rapper, but I made it, you know, in my own lane. And I think that mm-hmm. is something that I really stress, especially for all young creatives, is like, yeah, we want to go viral tomorrow, but you still want to be living in your truth 10 years from now. So make sure you're building something that can resonate and last that long.
I think the step of just taking that risk and just doing something for yourself, not working a traditional job, is like the hardest part. And you following through with it for so many years, even if you're not seeing success overnight, is the main point. You know, the fact that you followed through with it, I think that's like such a good reminder for people, especially now, who are expecting that, you know, viral content overnight. It's the hardest and biggest step is that you chose yourself and you chose that career even when people weren't supporting you, and that you're following through with it. You know, like if you continuously make work just to see if other people appreciate it and just to see if other people are making it viral, like you're not going to succeed in the long term, because you're just getting validation from other people and it's not even guaranteed, you know? So I really like that you said that.
Well said.
No, I'd love to segue into just like the Kolkata, just because, you know, I'm in New York, so I'm always there. Mushroom, whenever he comes from Orlando to New York, we always
go
there.
Yeah, yeah, I love going out there.
I have my solo dates there. We get the soft serve from there. It's amazing. So
yeah. I appreciate you guys.
We really want to talk about, like, because I also follow your brother, Ayan, and he always talks about, you know, the difficulty with, like, having a brick and mortar type of business. And he even posted yesterday that I saw where he was like, yeah, all of these streets were once stores before, and now they're, like, out of business. So I wanted to ask you why you guys followed through with having that type of business instead of just e-com, and what actually made you follow through with that? Like, because that's a big risk to put down so much money, especially, I know you did it right before the pandemic. So, like, what actually made you put down so much money and, like, believe in yourself and follow through with the papers and, you know, have a brick and mortar type of business like that?
Yeah, great question. I think, so the context there is my brother and I ran a creative agency, a marketing agency for about 6 years, 5-6 years before KCC, and just been judicious about saving and spending and kind of figuring out in what our next, what would we invest in, right? Because marketing, well, not marketing, but the agency world is very demanding. It's basically you're on call for your clients all the time. It's hard to scale because you have to scale yourself. And it was something that, you know, I enjoy doing, but I could tell that my brother's heart was not all the way in it. And he was kind of too young to be open about it. And so we would, you know, we would start to butt heads about stuff. But when we decided to spin KCC out into brick and mortar, we had already been testing at farmers markets, pop-up stores, food festivals, private catering, you know, private events. We had been doing that for about 18 months. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, a lot of people may or may not know, but my brother used to, you know, every weekend, he used to wake up at 7 in the morning, walk or drive or take an Uber to a U-Haul, you know, thing. Load up a U-Haul, make chai at 8 in the morning in the middle of November, go stand at a farmer's market for 6 hours, damn, you know, and listen to customers and get feedback. And, you know, this is different. Like, you know, this is different. Like, it's real. Mm-hmm. Like, that was a $200, $300 cost, you know, to sign up for the farmer's market every semester or whatever.
Yeah.
That's how we started, you know. And, mm-hmm. and so by the time we had got to brick and mortar, we had so many data points where people, you know, all the events started getting bigger. We started doing bigger, you know, pop-ups. We started doing food festivals with Infatuation, you know, thanks to Anik Khan. We started doing this pop-up at Todd Snyder, which is like a menswear store in New York, where the line would just get longer and longer. And I was like, what do we do? The last thing we wanted to do was open brick and mortar, but we had so much data around it. And I think we had, again, conviction around the South Asian diaspora and story needing to have a hub and have a physical place to tell those stories. And so that's what led us to open. We invested all of our profits from the agency into this thing. And then 6 months later, we got shut down, you know, and my brother and I showed up damn near every day of the pandemic. The streets were empty, and we would either spend time in the cafe figuring out what was next, figuring out how to ship orders to other people in the country, or delivering chai to people around the city. You know, we would drive, him and I would drive in his Nissan Rogue from Avenue B and 3rd Street to like 135th in Harlem for like in like 15 minutes because there was no traffic, just for $40 so that we could, you know, have that go towards making rent in those first couple months. So again, like I would have liked it to go a lot of different ways, but we were molded in the fire, like for real. And this is like, you guys know my story. So it's like the seventh time I'm being molded in the fire at this point, right? This is like, it's hard, but it's nothing to me because I've seen worse. You know, again, I've seen way worse. And so it was just like, complaining's not going to help, you know, crying's not going to help. No one's helping us. Let's just figure it out. And so that led to us figuring out, you know, how to do an e-commerce channel, which would ship, you know, chai across the country in our chai mix. And I think I tweeted the other day, you know, our e-commerce business just crossed $1 million in the last 6 months, you know, and again,
congratulations.
It took a while. That's amazing. Right. 2-3 years later, it took a while. Thank you. But I don't know. It was like you either do this or you die. And I've been in that scenario before, you know, and I don't want to die, man. I like living. Living's, you know, it's definitely better than dying. And so
for sure,
that's just where we were at. It was like, it was a very uncomplicated decision to be like, we have to do whatever it takes. Mm-hmm. Did we get burned out? Yes. Did we, you know, did we have a lot of emotional fallout from that? For sure. Did I go to therapy? You know, did I start going to therapy after the pandemic because I had no idea how to cope with what I had been through? Absolutely. Mm. You know, like there's real life consequences to hustling and making these decisions for your business, which sacrifice your personal well-being. I don't know if people want to talk about that, but that's a real thing, you know? So I say that to say, yeah, there's a lot of fallout from it, but we got through it. Coca the Chai, obviously for us is, I think it's really important for culture to have a reflection of itself in its truest, you know, form. All of us in this chat and people around the world, nobody has felt like a brand has authentically spoken to them and met them where they're at in terms of their values and their aesthetic and, you know, culturally, you know. And I think that we're one of the first brands, especially in this space, but one of the first generation immigrant brands to really do that. And so I think the ceiling, you know, there is no ceiling on that if we do it right. But it's a high pressure, you know, it's a high pressure situation because when you're doing that, institutional money does not recognize that, right? So the people that are investing in Starbucks or concepts like that, you know, just mainstream concepts, they don't know what you're doing. So institutional money is not really convinced that you're doing the right thing. There's not enough money in your own community just because you guys are all kind of getting it together. So it's hard to kind of figure out, well, how are we going to fund this? And then the reality is to make real money, to create real wealth, to be able to actually build something that does have impact, you need to make sure you build something that is relatable to non-South Asian people or people who don't come from the same culture. Mm-hmm. So now how do you tread that balance between creating something that, you know, we have a customer profile, we call her Midwest Mary. You know, how does Mary in Kansas, who's 35 with two kids, who loves chai and can't wait to make Coca the Chai every morning, how does she still relate to the brand that can also relate to Mahua in Brooklyn or in Queens or whatever? That's a real challenge, you know? So that's the space that I live in now. But again, I'll take that problem over, you know, damn near all the other problems that I've had. So, you know, I like doing that, but that's the thesis of what we're building.
What I really like about KCC is like you are able to bring not only the diaspora together, but you're able to also connect to so many other people. Like I really like the segment that you guys have where like I think it's Ayan who just goes to random people with the chai and they just like ask them how to pronounce it, like where it's from. I just love that just because I feel like it really brings it to a wider audience. But I think so many people support you and you have so much success now because they can relate to your story and they can they're inspired, and also there's like a like vulnerability behind it, you know, there's a transparency behind it, and they also just, I don't know, it's not like a tacky way to feel represented, you know, there's actual like meaningfulness behind it. So you guys are doing amazing. I love your social marketing, like you guys are killing it. And I'm also glad that, you know, from the beginning, especially during the pandemic when so many businesses closed down, unfortunately, you had the choice of either closing down so early on or just moving forward without a choice, you know? And I really like how you just use that to your advantage.
Can I give a spicy take while I have this moment? I mean, I'm gonna tie back into representation because you mentioned that too.
Going back
around. Hot take time. No, I mean, first of all, thank you for that. I think hearing that from people in the community means a lot, because that's ultimately why we built this and sacrificed, you know, what we did for it. Hot take about representation, or just like tying it all together, is the reason I'm not a fan of representation, the reason that I have some spiciness towards it, is because I think representation has become an umbrella for people to do a lot of garbage work. Just a lot of like low hanging fruit stuff that just goes under like, well, this is, you know, in the name of representation. And it's like
who? Call out.
Nah, I'm not going to do that, man. Cause everybody got their unique story. Everybody got their own story. But I will say, I call out generic things. So I have no beef with that. Anybody, you know where to find me. I think a lot of music, especially in South Asian culture, you know, I stand for artists. I go to war for artists, literally. Mm-hmm. A lot of music coming out of our community is really bad. It's just bad. It's a lot of people that work at Google during the day and then want to go home and have this alternative persona. Mm. And it's just not there, fam.
They're like, just like putting in, they're putting in all of the buzzwords, like South Asian buzzwords.
You know what I'm saying? And you're wearing a sari, or you're wearing a dhoti, or you're wearing sandals, and you think, you know, you on. Respectfully, I respect everybody that has a creative story, but I think it's like, it's just not good. And yeah. we gotta be honest about that. I think a lot of fashion that comes out of, I think a lot of first generation immigrant fashion in general. I'm gonna put this saying in my community on a t-shirt, and now I got a fashion brand. It's garbage. It's garbage. Yeah. Sorry, we gotta stop doing that. Like, just stop doing that. I feel you. I think there's brands like Rasta who are doing incredible, you know, work in terms of like really creating dynamic things, you know, and it's like, yeah, it's hard. What they do is really hard. That's the point. It's supposed to be hard. So I think representation has become this thing. It's very two-dimensional. You say you're doing it in the name of representation, boom, it's validated. Doesn't have to be good or not. So that's my spicy take. And this does not go to just the South Asian community. People don't need to question my gangster in this realm. I've put on for my community for a very long time. People know, you know, the work that I've done. And I say this with an open heart, like, yo, we got to just be better. And just because you're doing it under representation does not make it good. Sorry, fam. There's a lot of chai companies that are just not good. I hate to say it. You know,
like who?
Yeah, you know. Yeah, you know. Of course, know. You know. They know. Nah, I'm not gonna call them out, man.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. I think something that I have to tell myself a lot of time is, like, you know, with me and Mo both being creative people and both of us expressing our creativity through, she has her own clothing line and she's an artist, I write, you know, we can deeply analyze, you know, somebody else who's doing the same thing and try to, and we can understand how much like love and devotion they really put into it compared to us. But I also think, like, for the everyday person, I think, like going back to, like, me seeing Apu on The Simpsons, like, whether he was good or bad, like, I just loved seeing it, you know? And especially at a time, like, maybe things are different now with there being so much, like you said, but I just remember back then, man, like, anything I saw, I was just, like, it just made me happy, you know? And so sometimes, like, with us being creative individuals, we analyze things really deeply. And I think a lot of times I have to just put myself, like, to the corner and be like, man, like, at least we have it. At least there is this, you know.
It's a great point. And I want to clarify what I said too, is like, I think everyone deserves the right to be creative, right? So if you have this idea that you're working on, like, please by all means develop it. But you do not need to publish or go live or be this you you ironed on a shirt and now you are a fashion entrepreneur. You're on Instagram. You're going right. in. Like, I think that's yeah. where the difference is. Is yeah, like
he got someone in his head. Like, he's talking.
Nah, I really don't. Cause I don't even be thinking about. I don't even be online no more like that. But more of yeah. what it is like I don't want to be like the I don't old man yells at clouds. Like, that's not what I'm doing. Everybody should be creative if they want to be, because they deserve to be. But it's like mm-hmm. you don't necessarily have to. Go like grow live from with it. Everything yeah. yeah like grow like put the time in to actually get good at what you're doing and mm-hmm. then bring it to the world. And again, it's that patience thing where I feel like we're just in such a rush to prove mm-hmm. you know that we got it like that, and a lot of times it's garbage and it's not it.
We got a hot take here it. With the knee. You're never gonna hear this anywhere else.
I gave it to you guys first.
It's exclusive.
It's off my chest. Let's go.
All right, I got one last question before we do the lightning round. So you work with your brother. Mashun and I, we've been together for like 3 years almost. So what is it like working business with family? Because I know there's like a saying, don't do business, don't travel, and don't live with family, because that's where you see like someone's true colors.
I think to add on to that just a little bit, the two of us also have siblings. And I think sibling relationships is something that a lot of people have very rocky roads with. I would love a little bit of input on like how you've gone about just creating as strong as a bond as possible to where it's just like, you know, you can't let it go.
Yeah, I'm gonna try to synthesize this as quickly as possible. I think we owe a lot of credit to our parents for really like nurturing the bond between the two of us, right? My brother and I think they were always like, there's not a lot of things that are guaranteed in this world, but your love as brothers can be guaranteed. And just mm-hmm. something that was seeded early on. But at the same time, the reality of working with your family is very difficult. Like I mentioned, my brother and I ran an agency together, and we argued, beefed, and fought a lot during that time. He was young, and I will go ahead and on the record and say he was immature. He knows he was. But I was also immature because I would react to his immaturity, right? We didn't understand each other, and we didn't have healthy ways of disagreeing with each other and still finding solutions. We didn't have healthy habits around acknowledging someone's shortcomings and not taking it personally, or we just didn't understand each other as well. And we both went to therapy individually for different things. And I think what it did was it made us more understanding and having better tools to communicate around frustration and anger. And because when it's family, you don't hold anything back, right? Because you know that mm-hmm. ultimately they got to be family tomorrow at the end of the day. Like, you wake up tomorrow, you're still family. And that's a good thing. But it's also like it leads to a lot of, you know, things being said and done that are like there's no limit, right? Because there's this implicit understanding that they're not ever going to not be family. So my brother and I today, we have a really healthy, enjoyable working relationship. We don't always agree on everything, but that's a product of going through the fire. So a couple things that I think when working with family is really important is I think you have to create accountability and have a constant kind of way to check on that. Because with family, it's like you can let that person slide in ways that you would never let a professional or a friend or someone you hire slide. And so my brother and I I'm probably more on this than him. I do not let him slide on anything that he's supposed to be accountable for, because I wouldn't let employee five slide. So why would I let my brother slide? The second thing that I think is really important is learning how to disagree in a healthy way. People are not meant to agree on everything. That's normal. In business, there's a lot of things that people see differently on. Normal. You need to build a cadence, habits, tactics, tools on how you guys can disagree and still find a solution, or still move on, or still come back to it, or bring in more input. Whatever it is, you need to know how to disagree in a healthy way. And the third thing that we are not doing well that we're working on now is creating space for things away from work. Kind of knowing when, hey, the week is over, or hey, I'm going to come over, but we're not going to talk about work. We're going to go enjoy outside, or we're going to play video games. I don't play video games, but theoretically, if I did, just like doing things that are not like, hey, we are both in the founder's mode right now, because I work 20, I think about work 20, I live in my work mode 24/7, and he's very like, I need time away from that, which I respect. So we're working on that now, but yeah, it's never easy, but I do think it's worth it. I think when you get, you know, whether it's getting money or getting accolades or whatever it is, you know, whenever you're building something with the people you love the most, I think, you know, that's like, that's what life is and should be. You know, I think that's like the, yeah, one of the most fulfilling things about life. So yeah, really proud of my brother. I'm proud of how, you know, far he's taken, you know, the product and everything that he does at KCC. But you know, we had a disagreement yesterday, and so, you know, we are not really like super talkative this morning because we're still kind of coming back to it after, you know, we disagreed on something, and that's normal.
Yeah,
it's a hard one, especially in South Asian families where family dynamic is so overpowering, you know. Yeah. Like we're very clear with our rest of our family, like, yeah, this is not a family business. Like, this is my brother and I building something. I mean, your input That's is funny. Not welcome because you don't know what you're talking about. And I'll listen to you and I'll entertain you, but this is not like, can I get a job for so-and-so, second cousin, second uncle, because they're unemployed and it's on me now. Like, no, that's not what this is, you know? Mm-hmm. So you got to make difficult demarcations at the right time.
I really like the emphasis on separating work from just being with your brother, because I think that's so important, especially because as a creative, I think our minds are always running 24/7. I can always talk to Mishun about the podcast, what we can do better, but sometimes it's just like, you know what, this night, let's just talk about other stuff, and that's really important. And I also like that now that you are your own boss, you are kind of spreading out your wins to people that you care and love about, and it's like you're giving more opportunities with the opportunities that you have, you know, and I really appreciate that.
For sure. Sorry, I know I talked a lot.
No, you're good. No. You want to move on to the lightning round, Mishun?
Let's do it. Before that, I just wanted to thank you real quick for all of the like input that you've given
all
us.
All the gems.
I think you're very, very wise. And I, you know, I typically have a lot more to say, but I think this whole pod, I've just been very active listening to you. So thank you for, you know, everything
thank
that you've
you
shared with us.
Thank you guys. Thank you guys again. There's no platform to tell my story if you guys don't invite me on. So it goes two ways. And I appreciate that.
For sure.
Thank you, Annie.
Cool. Let's move on to the lightning round. We just got some silly questions for you. We've talked about goddamn working and whatever. We're not going to talk about work right now. We're gonna lollygag a little bit.
I think if you got some spicy takes though, so give me some credits.
True.
The first thing I want to ask you is you know, because I remember when Jay-Z dropped God Did, the first line he was like, the first line I heard it and I literally thought of Kogata, and he was like, Hove did, Lord forgive me for what the stove did. I was like, man, I know he's gonna say something about that. I heard it and I knew it was coming. So I just want to ask you, what's your favorite just rap bar
of all time? Favorite rap bar of all time?
First one that comes to your head. What is your favorite or not? Just some of that
stuff.
Oh,
my God. That's a really good question. I never thought of it that way. I mean, you know, Biggie's death anniversary was yesterday. It was all a dream. I used to read Word Up magazines like that. You know, it's probably not the answer that I would give on any given day. But today it's like, yeah, it was all a dream. That's a real bar, you know, and I could relate to that. So probably that. And then Jay said, you know, remind yourself, nobody built like you, you designed yourself. And I think that's real too, you know.
I like
so.
That I think a lot of the time it's like, it's just like the simple shit that stuck with you, like something that Nisi said on my favorite song is Ocean Views. He said, man, these cars are really foreign, like these buildings are really high, and he's just like, man, like these buildings are really high, and that's just always stuck with me. It's like,
yeah,
you know, just like that like, man, like I always wanted this, you know.
That's a great line, and it's real. Yeah, I mean, Nip got so many of them. I don't want to get into it right now, but I could probably do 10
it's a
Nipsey
whole other
lines.
Episode.
Yeah. Just not going to do that to you guys.
Nipsey Bar's
not going to do that to you.
All right, we know you're a worldwide traveler. What's your favorite travel destination?
Oh my gosh, this is tough.
First, this lightning, the first thing I can
say.
Don't think about this.
I'm going to say Barbados. I've been there a bunch of times in the last 10 years. Indo-Caribbean culture is so fascinating, and you know, it's just a beautiful place, and so let's go with Barbados.
You ever got to go to South America, Latin America?
I actually haven't been. It's bizarre. I've like not been south of Mexico City except Barbados, but no, it's on my list.
Damn. I was in Colombia for 5 weeks, and it changed my life. I think South America is the most underrated, like, part of the world. I recommend
Say no
it
more.
To everybody.
Say no more. Yeah. Say that.
Make it happen.
He's booking it for next month already.
Say that. I travel a ton, and I don't even talk. I don't post it. I don't share it. So it's like, yeah. It's this weird thing where I think travel. Yeah, I'm happy you guys asked that question.
Yeah, of course. All right, favorite Ja flavor.
Signature masala,
I think that's mine too. Yeah
back to basics, real.
Basic classic
on it for sure. Our last one, I know you said you work 24/7, but I don't care if you said that or not. What is like your go-to like New York City leisure activity? Like, it's Friday night, it's 6 p.m you got none to do, like there's nothing, like Saturday is free, nothing. What are you doing Friday night?
See, that's not true. But if it was true, hypothetically, Friday night at 6 p.m., what am I doing? I'm going to see my homies DJ somewhere, you know, Double House or wherever they're at. Like, I'm participating in culture. But then Saturday morning, me and my homies are going to go play golf. So there's a little bit of that, that I'll indulge in. But yeah, for me, leisure is travel, playing golf, or just being, you know, somewhere else.
I like that. You go out and then the next morning you kind of like detox and have a
go out
golf activity. Yeah.
That's the old man life, but you know, I'm embracing it. So
it's a good balance. Good balance. All right, Mashun, you know, we do our 10 second advice. The thing about Mashun is though, he takes 4 hours to find his advice and then he tells it
it's
in like a good 15 minutes. So let's try to think of some 10 second advice for all of us. Mashun, you can go first.
I'm not going to give advice. I'm just going to give the Nipsey Hussle quote that I butchered before because I got it pulled up now. So in case y'all still listening, y'all wondering what the hell I was even talking about, I'm telling you right now. The reasonable man adapts himself to the world. The unreasonable man persists in trying to adapt the world to himself. Therefore, all progress and evolution depends on the unreasonable man. I love that. I remember when I first heard it. It's always stuck, except for now. But the concept has always stuck. And, you know, I always ask myself, like, is this going to work? Is this not going to work? And I think you just got to tell yourself, like, who cares? Like, just do you. And whatever happens, it was meant to happen.
I'm really happy you mentioned that, man. That's beautiful.
Thank you.
Honey, you got 10-second advice?
Nah, she's asking you because she don't got nothing. She literally don't. Nah, go ahead. What you got?
No,
I want Mahi to go first because I feel like I've been talking this whole time.
Fine. I'll go first just to get like actually 10 seconds out. I think mine is it's natural to not know everything and it's natural to not have everything figured out. But don't let that stop you from reaching your full potential. Learn from other people that are smarter than you. Don't use that as like a way to be jealous about them and just hate on them, but you know, learn and just keep going even if there is failure and if there is unknowingness.
So I would add, I would just add, know the difference between when someone is giving you advice and when someone is projecting their fears onto you. Those are
good ones.
Two different things that often come in the same form of as advice, but they're very different. Like
that's fire.
That's a good one.
I like that. Cool, man. Ani, thank you so much. This was an amazing time. And I've personally gotten a lot out of this. I hope everybody listening gets a lot out of this. Where can they find you?
At Kolk of the Chai. No, I'm at Ani Hustles across all socials, Kolk of the Chai, 3rd Street and B. We are opening a second cafe in Soho.
Ooh,
very soon.
Really?
The first time expansion. I said it publicly.
That's amazing. Congrats. That's crazy.
Yeah. God willing, so we'll see. But I can't give the address yet, but soon enough. So yeah, find me in the city. Find me at Kolk of the Chai.
Oh, that's amazing! Congrats. It's gonna be a little bit closer than taking the train and then walking a few blocks.
Absolutely.
But yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for giving us your time. We know that you're busy. We've been trying to do this for like 7 months now, so we really appreciate you coming on for like an hour and a half. You know.
Thank you guys for the thoughtful questions and all that. Please edit, cut me out where I was chatting too much, but I appreciate
you
guys
keeping it all. Thank you everybody for listening. We'll have links to everything in the description. Follow us, rate us, review us, all that good stuff. Thank you guys. And
we love you guys.
Allah Hafiz.
Allah Hafiz.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.